So before I begin, are there any questions on the new programming assignment? Has everyone taken a look at the problem, what needs to be done? Okay, so if you have questions, we are here. But the only thing I would recommend is to start well in advance of the deadline, so that you don't run into a time crunch. And the other recommendation was, if you have done it by yourself, see if you want to team up with someone. Okay, again, it's not a requirement, but the assignments increase in effort needed to complete them as you go along. So it's better for your own sake to reduce your workload. Okay. All right. So let's continue where we left off last time. So we were talking about concurrency control. So there's one technique, timestamp based concurrency control, that we started discussing but couldn't finish. So I'm going to finish that. Let's get the lights here. So I'm going to finish the discussion on concurrency control, and then we will start a new topic, which is going to be consistency and replication. Okay. So let's talk about, or let's recap rather, timestamp based concurrency control. So just to again recap what concurrency control itself means, this is basically the technique that your transactional system uses to allow multiple transactions to execute concurrently or in parallel. Okay. And you want to preserve certain properties. In particular, in this case, we want to ensure asset properties. Okay. Asset properties are atomicity, consistency, isolation, and durability. Okay. Isolation essentially, which is a synonym for serializability, essentially says that even though the transactions are executing in parallel and their operations are getting interleaved, you want the end result to look as if each transaction executed sequentially in some order. Okay, so you want to the system's end result to be as if you executed transactions sequentially one at a time, even though they are executing in parallel. So that was the problem. So we looked at optimistic concurrency control. It doesn't use any locking. So it uses, after the fact, you check whether there is a conflict, and if so, you terminate transactions that caused conflicts. And pessimistic concurrency control uses locks to enforce that there will not be any conflicts at all. Okay, so those are the two techniques. So timestamp based concurrency control falls in the latter category, that of pessimistic concurrency control. And the idea here is, rather than using locks, you use timestamps to figure out whether there is a conflict, and if so, you abort transaction. So basic idea is, for every record or every data item in your store, you will have a timestamp, which is essentially the last modified time. So you have a last modified read time and last modified write time. Okay? And whenever a transaction begins, it itself gets a timestamp. This could be logical timestamp. We don't really specify how these timestamps are derived, so assume that they are logical timestamps. Okay? So whenever a transaction begins, it gets a timestamp, and whenever it wants to access a data item, it looks at the read or the write timestamp. If it turns out that some newer transaction has come along and or has already modified this data item, that essentially means that you have a conflict and you have to terminate one of these two transactions. Okay, because one of them has caused a conflict, so if you terminate one of them, the other can proceed. So the typical rule is to terminate the older transaction. Yeah, because the newer one has already gone ahead and made modification. So if you anyway, the older one cannot proceed because somebody has caused the conflict. So you terminate the older one. Okay. So you have, as I said, maintain these timestamps and you compare it with that of the transaction. Okay. So here is how it works. So if you are reading X, data item X, a transaction, you compare the timestamp of the transaction with the most recent modification time. Okay, that's max write timestamp, is the last time this object was written to by any transaction in the system. Okay, so if the max write timestamp is last modified time is newer, that means someone has modified, some newer transaction has modified it, you abort. Otherwise, you perform read and then you update the read time. Okay, that's the max read timestamp. For write, what you do is you compare the timestamp of the transaction with either the read timestamp or the write timestamp. Has some newer transaction either read or returned to this data item? And if so, if there is a newer transaction, then you abort the current one. This is an older transaction, you abort. Otherwise, you perform the write and you update the write timestamp. Yes, question.
Could two processes update the read or write timestamp at the same time?
I didn't follow what you're asking.
So, like, it thinks that it does a check, and it sees that it is not less, and two do this check at the same time, and they both write their timestamp in.
Okay. Question is, if there are two transactions running and they both write their timestamp.
If you don't have locks, you can't assume that they will both try to write to these variables at the same time.
Right. So what you have to do is, I mean, these variables are global data structures, right? So you have to at least protect them with a lock, even though you may not have protected the table itself with a lock. Otherwise, you cannot ensure any atomicity as far as the updates of these things are concerned. So that much you have to do. Okay. So, is this clear what the timestamp-based concurrency control does? So simple idea, you're just using timestamp to detect a conflict. If there's a conflict, you abort transaction. That's the basic idea. So that's all we have to say as far as concurrency control is concerned. I will have a handout on concurrency control topics, because as I mentioned, the recent edition of the book actually took some of that material out and spread it across multiple chapters. So I will prepare a short handout that has all of this material in written form in addition to these slides. Okay? So that is something I was planning to hand it out today, but looks like it will be Tuesday. Okay. So if you look for this material in the book, you will not find it. And so that's the thing to keep in mind. Okay. So now we are going to switch to the next chapter, which is consistency and replication. Okay. So today we are going to look at consistency models, which include data-centric models and client-centric models. But before we do that, I want to introduce this notion of replication and what does consistency mean in this context. Okay. So basically, why replicate at all? What does replication mean and why do we care about replication? Okay. So assume that you have your usual distributed system or a distributed application, okay, and you are trying to service a large number of users. Okay. Typically, if your application runs on a single machine or has all of its data on one machine, you are bounded by the capacity of whatever this machine can service in terms of total number of users. If your concurrent user base exceeds what a single machine can sustain, okay, or a disk on that machine can sustain, then you have no choice but to create additional copies, okay, of either the application or the data. Okay. Basically, that and what that means is you are replicating either the data or computation or both. Okay. There are two types of replication. Okay. You replicate the data that the system serves, or you replicate the computation or the service itself. Okay. They could be done independently of one another. So if you go back to your project, for instance, where we said the front end is replicated but the back end is not. Okay. Which of these two are you implementing in your assignment? Okay, you're replicating the computation. The service is getting replicated. The code is actually getting replicated on multiple machines, but your data is still centralized. Okay, there's only one copy of the data. You have not replicated it. Okay. So as you can imagine, okay, you could actually, so if your application is compute bound, it makes sense to employ compute replication. You basically have, you do a lot of computation within each process. Okay, and then so you have the capacity of your application depends on how many concurrent requests can be processed by this application. Okay, and because the application is computable. On the other hand, if your application is I/O bound, which means it does relatively little computation but a lot of I/O, okay, then replicating the service itself doesn't buy you additional capacity because the bottleneck is on the at the disk level. So in this case, you want to actually replicate the data. Okay. So what that also means is for your programming assignment, we have implicitly assumed that your bottleneck is on the computational side of the application, not on the data. Okay. So at some point, as you replicate the computation more and more, eventually, okay, the single machine where the database tier resides will start seeing lots of concurrent requests, and it will itself become the bottleneck. So at that point, you will actually have to replicate the data itself. So in other words, you cannot just replicate the computation or just the data. At some point, you have to start replicating both. for scalability. Okay, but for small applications, you can pick which of the two is the bottleneck and only replicate that and get some additional capacity. But for very large systems, you really have to replicate both computation and data. Okay. So today we are not going to look at any techniques for replicating the computation. Okay, we will come back to that topic later on in this course. So today's focus is going to be on replication of the data itself. Okay. So then we have to ask, what is replication giving us? So we talked about performance already. Okay, we said you want to scale with number of users. Okay, so basically that's essentially scalability. But the other thing that replication gives you is, even if you didn't have to scale with number of users, it also gives you reliability. Okay, if you replicate the data and one machine goes down or one disk fails, okay, you can still keep your system up and running, okay, because all requests can be routed to the other replica. Okay, so replication always buys you two things. It gives you higher availability in the system, because if any one copy becomes unavailable, the system can still continue to run. Okay, that's the reliability. Okay. And the other aspect is, it gives you a better performance, because there are multiple copies. You can distribute the load across multiple replicas and as a result serve a larger number of requests or users in your system. In terms of reliability, it's not just a crash, you can also have corruption. Okay, so that's basically, a copy may become unavailable not because the machine crashed, but because the disk got corrupted or the data got corrupted. So you can tolerate both using replication. And within performance, it's just not the number of users, but you could also have geographically distributed system. The system could be globally distributed. You may replicate to optimize performance locally. Even though you may not have a large user base, you may replicate saying there may be a replica in, in North America and one in Europe. Okay? And users may be directed to the local, the nearest replica for performance reason. Even though the replicas may not be loaded to see a high enough load to require two. Okay? Just having one means that some users were far away. Okay, from this replica we'll see worse performance. So you replicate the performance, so dimension is sort of has two aspects. One is the total number of users and the other one is geographical distribution of users, and you can deal with both. Okay. Again, we will come back to all of this when we look at compute replication as well. Okay, so we'll just keep these two in mind. Okay. So now assume that you want to replicate your data. Okay, so compute replication we have put aside for, but you are replicating your data. So there are many issues you have to think about. Okay, when do you actually feel that you should replicate at all? At what point do you believe that you need to have more than one copy of your data? Okay, and if you assume that you need more than one copy, then how many should you have? 2, 3, 10? Okay, you have to decide how many replicas to create. Okay, this clearly will depend on the number of users in your system, how much you want to scale. It may determine the geographical spread of users. If your users are worldwide, you may have one copy of your data in the US, or rather in North America, one in Europe, one in Asia. So you could decide based on the geographical distribution of users. You could decide based on the total number of users, how many replicas to create. Okay? And related to the number of replicas is the location of replicas. Whenever your geographical spread, you also have to decide where to keep your replica. So that also determined is based on where your users are coming from. So you want the data to be as close to the users as possible. Okay. If you go remember when we did the DNS lecture, okay, I showed you an example of replication of websites. So in particular, we had looked at this Intel web page, Intel website, and we saw that there was actually a replica placed here locally within UMass. Okay. So that says that, so if you are coming from UMass, you actually have a replica very close to you. Okay. That's a good way of determining your replication, to figure out where your users are coming from and locate replicas close to users. Okay. Now, today we are not going to look at when to replicate, how many replicas to create, where to put these replicas. Again, we will come back to these issues in the context of compute replication. Okay. Today we are actually going to just focus on one issue with respect to data replication, that is consistency. Assume that you have created some number of replicas, you have determined where to place them, all of that, all of these questions you have answered. And then you still have to answer one more question, which is, now that you have multiple copies of the data, and or let's say just take a single data item, you have created multiple copies. You have this problem of consistency, which says that if any one copy is updated by someone, then other copies become out of date. Okay, so if you now service a user request with an older copy, then you have an inconsistency. You are actually giving them an older version of the data item. Okay. So consistency is essentially the problem of how to ensure that if a copy is modified, how do other copies know about it, and how do these changes propagate to other copies, so all of these copies remain consistent with respect to one another. Okay. This is the problem of consistency that we will look at. Okay. So if you have, essentially the problem is very simple. If you have multiple copies of a data item and you have writes coming into the system, writes to this data item, then what should subsequent reads see? Yeah, and how do you ensure that these writes to one copy get propagated to other copies in the system? That's the problem. Okay. So here is a slightly orthogonal dimension before we look at techniques, because it also has bearing on where you will implement your consistency algorithm. So there are two approaches. One is where the application is actually responsible for replication. The other one is where the system or the middleware handles the replication on behalf of the application. Okay? Depending on whether the application is doing the replication or the system is doing the replication for you, the consistency algorithm has to be implemented at either of these two layers. Either the application deals with it, system doesn't care at all, or the system has to deal with it. Regardless of where you implement it, your consistency algorithm has to provide certain semantics or certain properties of what it is promising to the end users in terms of consistency. And we will see that it's not as simple as either the data is inconsistent or consistent. There's an entire spectrum between what we will call strong consistency to weak consistency. And depending on which specific technique you implement, you get different types of guarantees from your system. And we'll look at what these guarantees are. Okay. So here are some something to keep in mind when you think about the cost of these various techniques that we are going to discuss. Okay. So let's assume that you have used replication, and you have multiple copies. And you can maintain these. So in particular, let's assume that there are n copies of a certain data item. So, so this is the same data item is replicated in this case 4 times, and we'll assume that there are arbitrary number of clients that are trying to either read or write to this data item. Okay? And any client can essentially go and access any replica. Okay, in particular, it can choose the one replica that is closest to it. So there are reads and writes coming into the system that are either reading this data item or writing to it. This could be a file or it could be a record in a database. It's an abstract notion of a data item. What it is not material here. Okay? Think of it as a file, doesn't matter. Okay. So now, depending on the relative frequency of reads and writes, okay, the cost of any consistency algorithm will be very different. Okay, so there is reads and there is that. So in particular, let's assume that the number of writes or the write frequency is significantly greater than the read frequency. Okay? Which means that the object is updated frequently and read infrequently. Okay, so consider that scenario. So what happens in this case is that regardless of which consistency model you pick, the cost of the consistency algorithm is going to be very high. Okay? The reason is every time there is a write, any of this data item gets written to, internally the system or the application, depending on whether this replication is done by the system or the application, has to propagate that write. So let's assume this is a write. So this copy has been updated. Those copies are out of date. So either your system or the application has to go and take this write and propagate it to this other object, saying update the value or update your the object accordingly so that everybody is in sync. Okay. So in other words, each write here has triggered n minus 1 additional updates that go to all these other data items. Okay. This is how the cache consistency algorithm is going to work Okay, every time there's an update, this update has to be propagated to everyone else. Okay, all other replicas in the system. Okay, so each write has triggered its n minus 1 writes. Okay, in other words, basically there are n writes, and if the number of the write frequency is significantly higher than the read frequency, then you are doing a lot of wasted work. Okay, in the system. In particular, let's just take an example. Let's assume that there are 100 writes for every read in the system. Okay. So every time there is a write, okay, you propagate all of these changes to all these other objects. Okay. And then the next write comes, you propagate those changes. Okay. So all of this is wasted work, because you did this work, nobody has read these other copies at all. Because there are lots of writes, so just when there are more writes than reads, then what you see a pattern where you have a sequence of write followed by a read, a sequence of write followed by a read, and so on. So basically, this write and this write is never read. So all the extra work you are doing here to propagate these writes to other replicas is wasteful from a perspective of a reader. Okay. Nobody is accessing the data item, so you may as well have not propagated them and only propagated the contents of this write. Because this is the read that is going to see what's the latest copy. Okay. Yes, you have a question there.
So if you do this, couldn't you just like buffer writes and only send updates like every now and then, not every time the write was issued?
Okay. So question is, if you knew this, why don't you buffer updates and only send it every once in a while? Okay. That's precisely the point I was trying to make. The consistency guarantee, okay, that you provide to the system has an impact, has a cost associated with it. Okay. Whether you are willing to pay the cost depends on what guarantee you want to provide and what is actually happening in the system. What does the workload looks like? If this is the workload, then you may not want to impose or provide a strong guarantee, because it has a high cost associated with it, and you are not seeing the benefit of paying that high cost, because there's all this wasteful work you are doing which is not needed in the system. Okay. On the other hand, if you have the opposite scenario, right? So if you have, instead of the write frequency being greater, let's assume that you have the read frequency being greater than write. So now the workload looked like this. You have lots of writes, then one read, rather lots of reads, then a write, and then lots of read, a sequence of read followed by write, and so on. Okay. So again, each of this write requires that you propagate that update to all other replicas. But this work is amortized across a sequence of reads that are going to come right after that write. So then it's well worth the price, because all of these reads, because you send the most up-to-date value, all of these reads see the most recent version of the object. Okay. So whenever the read frequency is higher than the write frequency, then the overhead of this consistency maintenance algorithm gets amortized across multiple reads, and you are getting the benefit of this whatever consistency semantics you pick, you will see the benefit. If it is the other way around, then if you choose unnecessarily strict semantics, then you will pay the price without seeing the benefit. That's the point to keep in mind. Okay? So all this is saying is, in this spectrum from strong to weak consistency, you have to choose the right guarantee, the right semantics, based on not only what the application needs, but also what the workload looks like. Okay? Because the workload is going to have an impact on the cost that you will pay. Is this clear? Any questions on this? Yes, there is a question.
The number of reads are very high, and the number of writes.
Yeah.
Would there be a possibility that before the write propagates to the arguments, then still appear in the arguments?
Okay. Question is, if the number of reads are very high and the number of writes, is it possible that a read will come in while an update is in transit? Yes. So none of this has actually told us what the consistency guarantee should look like. We can make arbitrary assumption as to reads and writes happening concurrently. That is exactly what the next discussion is going to be. What should a read see when it comes into the system? And if you are guaranteeing that you will always get the results of the most recent write, then any read that is coming in while a write is in progress essentially has to block until the update is complete. So we have to, those are things we look at. We hold off on that. So this is something to keep in mind. So now, just to make this a little more concrete, if you look at the case of the web, let's say web pages, okay, which of these two models do you think is true? Yeah, so typically in the case of the web, you will see that the read frequency typically exceeds the write frequency, because you update pages, but they don't get updated that frequently. Okay. the write frequency will vary depending on its home page of CNN, which may see updates every few minutes, to maybe your web page, which you update once a week, once a month. Okay? But there will be lots of intervening reads in between. Okay, so the read frequency typically is significantly higher than the write frequency. Okay, so if you actually replicate your website on multiple servers, okay, you will have to employ a consistency maintenance algorithm. But it does tell you that the price you pay for whatever technique you pick is worth the cost that it incurs. Okay, because there will be lots of reads that will benefit from this consistency maintenance. Okay, but there will be scenarios where this is true as well. Okay, so you have to think which application it is and what the workload is.
Like if you have like a blog or forum where people are not just reading but posting comments.
Yes, so you could have people posting and reading at the same time. Okay, so it all really depends on the scenario as to how many times things get read versus written. I mean, it could be that you are updating your web page, or you may have a blog. Okay, you update it frequently, nobody reads it. Okay, so you could have a blog that's not popular, and you replicate and you send all these updates to all your replicas, but you're not really you're incurring cost but no benefit.
So if you have lots of replicas and no one's reading, then it's kind of wasteful as well.
True. That's true. But I mean, the point is that the blog is sort of a contrived example, but if you may well be designing a system and you expect lots of users, okay, and you put in a heavy duty consistency algorithm, and then you see more frequent writes than reads because it's not as popular as you thought it would be, and then you paid a price without getting any benefit. So those are scenarios that are actually more realistic, where you have to plan carefully.
If you have a lot more writes than reads, is it best to just not replicate at all?
If you have a lot more writes than reads, is it best not to replicate at all? That depends really on the total I/O frequency. Okay, the total workload is the frequency of reads plus write. It may well be that the total frequency still exceeds what a single machine can sustain. Okay, in which case, you have to replicate. Okay, this is the total number of I/O operations. If the rate of these I/O operations exceeds what a single disk can sustain, then you have to replicate. You don't have a choice. Okay. Okay. So now, with that background, okay, this was all background as to why should we replicate, why do we care, and how do you pick the right consistency semantic. Okay. So now we are actually going to talk about various semantics. So there are two types of consistency models or consistency semantics that we will look at. Okay. So they are data centric or client centric. And the difference between them is as follows. So this is the picture to keep in mind. So these are clients or processes that are accessing, reading or writing to data. Okay. This is a distributed data store. These are disks on independent machines. As far as our discussion is concerned, assume that there's only one data item. It doesn't really matter. But what the data store is doing is presenting the abstraction of a single logical store to the rest of the system. The rest of the system doesn't necessarily know or care that there is replication. Okay? It just goes to its local data store and it tries to read or write. Okay? The data store has to take care of if there are multiple replicas, what to do, where to fetch it, all of that. Okay? So these clients see the abstraction of a single logical data store, but the data store itself is distributed, and in particular data items are replicated. Okay. Now, depending on whether the consistency model is designed from the perspective of what a single data item is seeing or what a single client is seeing from the data store, you will have a data centric or a client centric consistency. In data-centric consistency, we are concerned about an individual data item that is seeing lots of reads and writes, and we are trying to impose some ordering on what happens after a write and what should the read see. Okay, so we are looking at consistency from a perspective of a single object, single file, single record, single variable, whatever it is that you are replicated. Okay. In a client-centric client-centric model, we are looking at consistency from a perspective of a process or a client or a machine, okay, or a user. So a user makes a request, what should the user see that comes back from the store? Okay, the web-based model is an example of a client-centric model. If you request a web page, okay, you are asking the question, is this browser or user getting the most recent version of this web page that may be replicated on multiple machines. That's a client-centric model. A data-centric model, on the other hand, you can look at it from a perspective of a web page. Someone is updating and someone is reading. And you are asking the question, is a read that comes after an update, does it see the most recent update or does it see something older? Okay, that's a data-centric model. Okay, so we'll look at various semantics in either one, but we'll start with the data-centric. So think of it as a contract between a process and a data store, which is if the processes obey certain rules on reading and writing, then the data store will provide certain guarantees, and we'll see what the guarantees are. Okay. In particular, any consistency model, okay, regardless of what it is essentially trying to do one thing. Okay. So what you are trying to do is all models will try to return the results of the most recent update. Okay, if you want to ensure consistency, at the end of the day, all you are trying to do is, no matter who reads, that read has to receive the most recent update in the system. Okay, otherwise, you are violating consistency. Okay. Now, not all models will actually define, how to define the most recent read is where these models will differ. Okay. Because there is no global clock in the system. Okay, if there are multiple readers or writers, you don't really know which one happened before which one if you are not synchronized. If everything was synchronized, you had a global clock and you had a total ordering of events, then defining what's the most recent read is not a problem. Okay? But since you don't have a global clock, this is a problem. Okay? And it's not just the notion of a global clock, it is also that any operation, read or write operation that you send into the system takes a certain latency before it hits the store. Okay, so let's take the simple example. Okay, let's assume for simplicity that there is only one replica, not even multiple replicas. There are two clients, okay, client A and client B. Okay, let's assume that both of them issue an I/O operation. Let's say this is a read and that's a write. Okay, both of them issue this at exactly the same time. Okay, let's say noon, and let's assume that they do it at noon, but because the distance of these clients from the store is maybe different or arbitrary, then the speed of light latency before this read actually hits the store. Okay, you have to how do you decide which of these was actually happened first? Okay, you don't know. Okay, if you look at it from a perspective of the store, this client may be further away. Okay, so this write may arrive here after this read, although they were issued at the same time. Is that the ordering you should pick? Okay. Or is it the other way around? You actually look at when the client issued the read or write. Okay. So how do you define what is the most recent write, or what ordering do you impose on certain reads or write? Could be different. You can make different assumptions. Saying I will use the time at which it was issued at the client, I'll use the time at which the request actually arrived at the store, and if there are multiple of these, not just one, then these are also not synchronized. So if there is one coming request coming here and one coming here, okay, how do you order those when you don't have a global clock? So depending on what assumptions you make, we'll get a range of consistency models, and that's what we will see. Okay. So we'll start with the simplest, which is strict consistency. Okay, this is the ideal scenario. So any read always returns the result of the most recent write. Okay, very simple. Regardless of when you issued it, when it came, you basically return the result of the most. So as I said, already mentioned, okay, this is an ideal model. It implicitly assumes the presence of a global clock. It's the only way you can always guarantee that the most recent write is the one that you are using to reply to a read request. Okay. So what this also means is that any write is immediately visible to all processes in the system, no matter where they are. Okay, so it ignores in particular that these stores may be geographically separated. There is speed of light latency that's involved in if a write hits here. Okay, it's going to take a certain amount of time, maybe milliseconds, doesn't matter, okay, before those updates are actually propagated to other stores. What happens when you reach that have arrived, since the write is actually processed here but hasn't reached here? Okay. In strict consistency, those reads will have to actually return the results of the most recent write, even though the write update is still propagating. So you don't even know that it has actually appeared here, because you cannot propagate information faster than speed of light. Right? So you have to. So what that means is essentially this is really difficult to achieve in real system because network delays are finite and they are variable. But we will look at certain techniques that will allow you to do this. Okay, they will have high overheads, but you can do this even without assuming synchronization. Okay, but that's the ideal model we start off with, SIG consistency. It says any read always returns the result of the most recent write. Okay, so global ordering, global clock, one event. So here is a model that is weaker than strict consistency. It's called sequential consistency. Okay. So sequential consistency assumes there will not be a global clock. Okay. So it assumes that all operations are executed in some sequential order. Okay. And so long as all processes agree on the order, it doesn't really matter what time they were issued. If you just agree on some ordering, saying this read happened before this write and that write happened before this read, just agree on this and all processes agree on this, you have what is called sequential consistency. The only thing you cannot violate is program order. Okay, if a single program issues a read followed by a write, you cannot change that order. You have to respect that ordering. But any interleaving, you are okay with. So what that means is the following. So let's assume there are two processes, A and B. So you have RA. So these are the reads and write issued by a single process. So you have this sequence of reads and writes that two processes are issuing. You can interleave them in any order. So just basically you take these order and interleave them so long as you respect program order. Okay, so long as you don't swap these writes within a program. You can assume any interleaving. Okay? And so long as all processes agree that that is the interleaving, okay, you are okay. You are guaranteeing sequential consistency. Now, question is, why is this not strict consistency? Yes?
Because the write B may or may not be before the read A.
Yes.
May or may not see that update.
Yeah. So, the reason this is not strict consistency is, let's assume that along the timeline, this write has actually occurred in real time before this write. Okay. Sequential consistency allows you to assume the opposite order. You can assume that the writes actually were in this order, that this write appeared before this write. Okay. So long as these processes agree that that's the order, you are allowed to pick that other order, okay, which a strict consistency would not have allowed you to do, because that would have said, if in real time, if this actually happened before this, then that's the order you have to respect. Okay. In sequential consistency, all you are doing is you are respecting the sequential ordering of reads and writes within a process. That's called program order. A program executed in this order, across programs you will take any interleaving, so long as you agree that if both processes agree that this rewrite happened before this write, even though it was the other way around, you will still be sequentially consistent. Okay, this is why it's a weaker guarantee. It allows you to violate strict consistency semantics, but because you are preserving sequential program execution order, you have what is called sequential consistency. Okay, so here are two examples. Okay. So in this example, this is an example of sequential consistent operation, and that one is not. Okay. So this is time. Okay. So you have, they are writing to a data item X. There's only one data item. Okay. So process P1 wrote A to X. Okay. It wrote the value A. So think of it as a variable. And process P2 wrote B to X. Okay. In real time, this write has happened before this write. Okay. But so long as processes agree on some order, any ordering is okay. So we'll assume in particular that all these four processes assume that this write has actually happened before this write. So when you read X first, this process actually gets the value of B, okay, and then it sees the value of A. So it's seeing the writes in the exact opposite order. And this process is also seeing that write in the exact opposite. But they are all agreeing that that's the order, that the B was written to X before A was written. That's still sequentially consistent, although it's not strict consistency. Okay, so that's exactly what I was showing here, that this write has actually happened before this write, but everybody agreed that it was the other way around. And that preserves program order. There's nothing in program order that you have violated. And so long as that's the case, you're okay. Here's a scenario where you are not sequentially consistent. Okay, again, this write happened before this write. So this process, when it reads, it sees B before A. Okay? And this process sees the result of this write before the other one. Okay. So this process believes that this write happened before this write because it's, or rather that one happened before that because it sees B and then A. Okay. This process sees the other way around. Okay. So they are not agreeing on an order. Okay. So that is the reason that that interleaving is not sequentially consistent, whereas this one is. Okay. Is that clear? And neither of them are strictly consistent. Any questions on this? Yes, no, not clear. Okay, so let's look at some more examples and maybe if we can go on, we can revisit all of this. Okay, so the other, the next model is what is called linearizability. Linearizability is essentially sequential consistency and it imposes one more constraint. And the constraint essentially is that if a timestamp on an event or a timestamp on a read or a write is less than a timestamp on some other read or write, then any interleaving you pick will should have that operation precede some other operation. Okay. So in other words, this is actually stronger than sequential consistency. It's not only saying you preserve program order, you agree on an interleaving, but it says that if there are timestamps on these reads or writes, you better respect the order of timestamp. Don't pick an ordering which will say that something that happened later was placed in a reverse order. Okay. If these timestamps, now the issue is, if you had a perfect synchronization algorithm, okay, that synchronize all clocks perfectly, then linearizability is the same as strict consistency, because it's saying I timestamp events and I derive a total order. Okay. But we can assume here that you are using logical clocks to assign timestamp, not physical clocks. Okay. So in case you have logical clocks, then linearizability is not going to be the same as strict consistency, because you don't have a globally synchronized clock. Okay. But you still assume that there are timestamps. You can use Lamport's clocks to assign those timestamps that we have seen. So in this case, if you have a timestamp, if there's a message that P1 sent to P2 and this write happened after that, then that will cause this operation to have a lower timestamp on that operation. So in addition to preserving program order, you have to respect timestamps on those. In those cases, it will be a logical timestamp. So both of these will have to say that this write has happened before this write. So in other words, this would not be linearizability. Okay, so I mean it is not a linearized schedule. It has to be the other way around, which is exactly what strict consistency would also give you in this case. Okay. Now again, remember saying it says if timestamp of X is less than timestamp of Y, then operation X should precede operation Y. If the timestamps are not comparable for whatever reason, okay, because there was no message that went from one process to another, then you cannot do anything. You can agree on either ordering. This is why it is linearizable but may not be strictly consistent. Okay, so here is an example of a linearized schedule. Now I don't know if I should go through the whole thing, but there are three processes and there are three variables X, Y and Z. Each process here writes to one of the variable and reads the other two. Okay? By doing print you are reading that these are shared variables. So here is basically four different interleaving of these events, okay. And this is what each of these prints in this order saying 0 0 1 0 0 1 1 0, and so there are four of these interleaving. So this is also what we will call the signature of this interleave. The assumption, yeah, not the assumption, what the vertical axis is time, and the claim here is that all of these are linearizable.
Assuming all the reads have the same order and all the writes have the same order and have the same timestamp?
Assuming that all the... No. So, issue is now why. So, we'll come back to that, what you just asked in just a moment. Okay. Here, there are no real timestamps that we are seeing. Okay. But the claim is this is linearizable. So, let's try to understand why. So if you look at these processes, although there is no explicit message communication, we will claim that they are still communicating with one another. just by looking at this program, can you claim that there is communication between these processes?
Well, those are right, just the property of that, right?
So, if you go back to our discussion fairly early on, we said there are two forms of communication. There is explicit communication where you communicate with messages, and there is implicit communication where you use shared memory to communicate. Okay? X, Y and Z are shared variables, they are shared between these processes. By writing to X and then subsequently some other process reading that value of X, this is communication. So you essentially, process P1 here has written the value 1 to X, and process P2 has read that value of X. So this information is getting transmitted from P1 to P3 to the shared variable X. In particular, sent a message saying 1. What does 1 mean doesn't matter. But you essentially have a shared variable where you are writing and this one is reading from that shared buffer. Okay, that is a form of communication or message passing. Okay. So what this means is process P. So once you return X and then you read X. Okay. So that's basically a message that has gone from here to here. Okay. So this print, this value of X that you read here, okay, has to be equal to 1. If this one actually, if this operation actually takes place after this operation, you can only read 1 in any interleaving. So what that means, okay, is if you set the value of X, okay, and then you subsequently you read the value of X, okay, you better print 1 for that X here. In this interleaving, was that you sent a message from this process to that process. Okay. So if you take this interleaving, so here you only set X to 1. Here you have printed Y and Z. Okay. So far the values of Y and Z are undefined. Okay. So we don't care what you have printed here. Okay. So this could be anything. It doesn't matter because no explicit messages have been sent. And here again Y is set to 1. Okay, anything after this that reads X and Y, better print 1. Otherwise, that will not be a linearized schedule. So, now you print X and Z. Okay? So, X has to be 1, which is what you see here. Z is still undefined, so we don't care what the program prints. Okay? So, it prints 0, which you will take. Okay, then you print X and Y, okay, both of which have been defined. So, those have to be 1 and 1. Okay? So, what this is saying is every time a message is sent, any subsequent prints actually have to take the value that was set by that message. Okay, and so if that is preserved, then this is linearizable. If that's not preserved, then this is not linearizable. In particular, if this was 00011, we would say that violates linearizability because the print X of here, so this, let's say, print 00. If this also prints 0, then we say that's not the right thing because X has already been set. A message has been sent and it has been received here, but you didn't get that message. Okay, so, I mean, that violates linearizability because you have to assume that one message was always sent before it was received. Is that clear, what I just said? So, the thing to keep in mind is although on the abstract here we are saying timestamp of X is less than timestamp of Y, and these timestamps can be set by sending messages as you do in Lamport's clock, these need not be explicit messages. You can send implicit messages by reading and writing to shared memory. So what this boils down to is if you are reading and writing shared memory, then you assume that those are your messages and assume that that ordering is maintained. If you do that, then you have a linearized schedule in addition to satisfying all the properties of sequential consistency. Okay, that's linearizability. So the next one is causal consistency. So causally related, so what this says is causally related writes must be seen by all processes in the same order, but concurrent writes may be seen in different order. So this builds on what linearizability was saying if you use shared variables to communicate and two writes are causally related, that's the ordering you have to agree on. Okay? This says nothing about program order, it only talks about, so here is an example of what causally related write means. Process P1 has written A to X. Okay. Process P2 has read X and it read A. So this, there is a message that went from here to here. Okay. And then process X, process P2 subsequently wrote B to X. Okay. So these two writes are assumed to be they are now causally related. Okay. Because the message has gone from this process to this process. So you have a message going here and then this operation has happened before this operation. So this write has happened before this write. using the happened before relation that we have defined. So any order that you pick subsequently always has to assume that that write has happened before that write. So in particular P3, the first time it reads X, it sees a B. Next time it reads X, it sees an A. So this is not causally consistent, because this happened before this. This one is seeing the events in the opposite order. That's not causally consistent. And here you are actually seeing the events in the order in which they happened. Okay?
So this is weaker than sequential.
I'm sorry?
This is weaker than sequential consistency.
Yes. It's weaker than sequential consistency because it says nothing about program order. All it is saying is if you have causally related writes, then you assume that they are related, you see them in the same order. Within a program you can change order, it doesn't matter. Okay? In particular, the other thing is concurrent writes may be seen in different order. So if you remove this read, that's what that second example. There's a write here and there's a write here. And the claim is these two writes are concurrent. Because there's no explicit message that has gone. If since you didn't do a read here, you wrote X to a shared variable, some other one process wrote X, but they didn't explicitly communicate. You are just writing but not reading. Okay, so there's no explicit communication. So then these are concurrent and you can see them in any order. In particular, P3 can see them in one order and P4 can see them in the other order. Okay, so you don't even have to agree on the ordering, which is why it is weaker than a sequential consistency. But in sequential consistency, even in this case, you have to agree on an ordering and stick to it, whatever that ordering be. Okay. Here, if you say if they are concurrent, we don't even care. Okay, why do we care if they are concurrent? Why should we even agree on an order? Okay, so that's causal consistency. And there are several more. Okay. There is a FIFO, so I am not going to go into all of those in more detail. So FIFO consistency says, writes from a process are seen by others in the same order, but writes from different processes can see in a different order, which means you don't even have to agree on an ordering across all the writes. Just respect program order for each process. Okay, you can assume different interleavings are seen by different processes. Okay, so long as you respect program order within a process, you just call it FIFO consistency. So now it turns out that even FIFO consistency may be too strong in certain cases. Okay, so we are seeing the sequence that goes all the way from strict consistency to something that's relatively weak, which is FIFO consistency. Everything else falls in between. Okay. So each of this has a cost, and the cost keeps going down as you go from strict to FIFO in terms of the consistency maintenance over it. But we'll see that many systems don't even assume this. They assume something even weaker than FIFO consistency, which even requires you to respect program ordering. Okay, so there is... So let me come back to this. So let me first summarize this table. Okay, this is the table that summarizes all of the semantics. You have strict, which is absolute time ordering. Okay. Linearizability, which is one step weaker than strict, say all processes must see shared access in the same order and according to some timestamp. Okay, you have to assume that if there is message passing, you assume some timestamp and then you have to respect timestamp order. Sequential consistency says you basically see them in the same order and you agree on all of that. Okay, so long as you have a program order and you agree on it, that's all you care about. Causal says only if they are causally related do you even need to agree. Otherwise you don't even have to agree on program order. Then okay. FIFO consistency says just preserve program order within each process and different processes can see different ordering of events in the system. Okay, one process can say this event, this write from this process and some other write happened in a certain order and some other process can see it in a different order. So long as within a process you are respecting program order, two writes are seen in that order, that's all you care about. Okay, so that's the ordering of various data centric. Yes.
Is causal stronger than FIFO? Because causal doesn't even guarantee program order.
Causal is stronger. This is the strongest, this is the weakest.
But like causal doesn't guarantee program order where FIFO does.
Actually that is true. So it is... You are right. Causal doesn't require you to respect program order. It only respects program order when there is explicit communication. If there is a communication here, then you are respecting program order here and here, but this, the two don't. So they are neither stronger nor weaker than the other, because one, yes, you are right. So it's not that there is a strict ordering in this case, especially between these two. Okay, only if there is communication here, then it becomes stronger, otherwise it's not. Any questions on this? Is this clear what actually the data centric consistency models are doing for us? I mean, they are giving you a sequence of guarantees. Each one is slightly weaker than the other one. It's trying to impose some ordering on where, what the most recent write was in the system and what reads should see from that write. Okay, so let me go back and talk about weak consistency. So in this case, what we assume is that there is a rather than the results of reads and writes becoming immediately visible to other processes, we'll assume that there is something called a critical section or a transaction. Okay? And we assume that the results of all the operations of this critical section and transaction become visible either at the beginning or at the end of the transaction. So any changes that are made in between are not propagated out. So this fits the transactional model well, in the sense you can make changes and you can roll them back and those changes never become visible, or if you commit then those changes become visible immediately. Okay. So now this is, there are two forms of this entry consistency and release consistency, and here is a quick summary of this. So entry consistency says that you make everything consistent at before you start a critical section. So before you start, you can query all replicas and say send me all your updates so you become consistent with respect to everyone else, and then you start executing your critical section. And release consistency says that when you exit, you make your changes visible to everyone else. In the entry, you are pulling changes from everyone else and then entering, so you enter in a consistent form. And in the release, which is exit-based consistency, you take all of your modifications that you made within the critical section and you propagate to everyone. You have to pick one or the other. They are of equivalent. In one case, you pull all the changes and then you begin. You make yourself consistent, then you begin. In the other one, you do it at the exit time. You make everyone else consistent. So then when anyone else starts subsequently, they are already consistent. They don't need to pull. Okay, is that clear? What the difference between entry and release is. So it basically, all it is saying is there's a begin critical section and there are reads and writes here, and there is an end critical section. In the entry, you basically make everything consistent when you enter the critical section, and then you start executing this. Okay, and then in the exit, you do it at exit time. So here you don't do anything. You are assuming that when you enter, you are already consistent. You make changes, then you propagate to everyone. So everyone else becomes consistent. So any subsequent begin critical section already starts in the consistent state. So you have to do it either at entry time or exit time, but not both. Okay. Is this clear? Okay, so what I'm going to talk about now is a model called eventual consistency. Now it turns out that all of these are good to study, but they are still expensive to implement. So a lot of existing systems that are out there actually don't implement any of these that we have talked about. It's neither strict nor FIFO nor sequential. They implement something called eventual consistency, which essentially doesn't give you any guarantee at all. Okay. All of those gave you some guarantees. Okay. Eventual consistency doesn't give you any guarantees. And the reason they pick eventual consistency is the following. Okay. It says many distributed systems have processes that where only a small number of those processes actually perform updates. Most processes just read and small number of them do the writes. Okay. So if you have a system like this, okay, how frequently should these updates be made available to other read-only processes? Okay, so the read frequency is dominating write frequency. Okay. The question is, how frequently should these updates be made available? So here are some examples. Okay. Let's take DNS, a domain name system. So changes to DNS, which means you add a new machine, you add a register, a new domain, are not very frequent. You will see changes, but they are not frequent as compared to the read frequency. DNS lookups are orders of magnitude more frequent. Every time you go to a web page, your browser has to do a DNS lookup. Every time you remote log into a machine, your browser has to do a DNS lookup. Every time you have two processes doing socket communication, there is a DNS lookup. So the DNS lookups are a lot more frequent than DNS updates. Okay. And then the question is, what is the tolerable level of consistency? If I go and update a DNS record, how frequently does it need to become visible to all these other clients that are now going to go come and read the DNS system?
I think they tell you through the day or two.
Yes. So in most cases, I mean, you are not given any guarantee. So wait for some time and eventually something will, this changes will trickle in and you will see those changes. Okay. This is exactly what eventual consistency says. It says if I make an update and it will propagate at its own pace, and at some later point in time all replicas will see this update and become consistent. Okay. So you are not giving any guarantee. One day is just chosen because most DNS servers go and talk to other DNS servers and pull their changes at least once a day. Okay, even that's not required, it's just something that is done in practice. So you have a system or a consistency model which says that updates are going to propagate and eventually all the replicas will see this update and catch up. Okay. Until then you will start seeing out of date values. So if you actually go and update a DNS record, you will see, and you go look it up somewhere else, you may say record not found. Okay. Even though you updated it, because changes haven't yet propagated to this other DNS server that is servicing the lookup. Okay. So this is a very weak model which says let's not give any guarantee at all. Okay. Many applications are tolerant of these errors and they will work okay. I mean, so it doesn't matter. Eventually things will be consistent and then we will catch. So this is what happens in domain name system. This is what happens in when you update your password, for instance. If you have a Unix environment, you log into workstation and you update a password. Okay, you update your user's or password for your login. And then you go to some other workstation immediately and try to log in there. You are not guaranteed that whether you have to use the old one or the new one. Although that you have already updated it and then you are going somewhere else. Right? The reason for this is there are multiple replicas of the password database. You updated it at one. Okay? And these replicas periodically send updates. Every half an hour they'll say, here are all the change password updates, here are all the new users, and they send it to someone else. So again, there is no guarantee at all. Okay? If this was strictly consistent, as soon as you update the password, you walk to some other machine and you log in, you should be able to use your new password. Because that clearly is happening after the update event. Okay. But system doesn't guarantee you. It doesn't make any guarantees. Some machines may actually allow you to use your new password. Other may not have seen that update and allow you to use the old password. So things are in an inconsistent state. Only thing that the system is telling you is at some point in time your changes are going to propagate. Your new password record will be updated at all the replicas that store the password database, and after some period of time every machine will allow you to use the new password. Okay. And as a user you are tolerant of this. You say, okay, maybe the change is not updated, for some time I might use the old one, but tomorrow everything is fine. Okay. So if you are tolerant of these kinds of error, then why pay the price of implementing a more expensive model? Okay. That's the point. That many scenarios, you are tolerant of errors if updates are not propagated immediately. So then let's not implement any specific semantics at all. Let's just implement what is called eventual consistency. Okay? And that's what many systems do. Okay? Now the only problem here is you might have what is called write-write conflicts if you are not careful. Okay, so in the password example, you might actually go update your password on machine 1. You walk to some other machine, let's say machine 25, that is talking to a password database that has not seen the update. Okay. You log in with your new password, doesn't work. Okay. Try your new password, you enter, and you say, oh, maybe I made a mistake, let me change it again just to be safe. Okay, and you change it, but in this case you use a different password from what you had picked on the first machine. Now you have a write conflict because you have two copies of your password database. Okay? You don't know which one might override which other one. Okay? because there, unless there's clock synchronization, the systems may not exactly know which one, which record was updated before which other record. Okay, so tomorrow when you come back, you don't know which of your new password would have actually taken over the system. Okay, it could be either one. Okay, that's a write-write conflict. Okay, this can happen in the system because they're not really giving you any guarantee and you have to deal with it. Okay, there's not much one can do about it. Okay, so I already mentioned that it's cheap to implement because there's no model. The only thing is there will be infrequent write-write conflicts that you have to deal with. Okay, and things are fine so long as user accesses the same replica. This is not even visible. If you are logging into the same workstation where you change your password again and again, you actually see the most recent password, for instance. You log in with that because that machine is talking to the same password database. So in most cases you will not even notice this inconsistency, but some cases you may if you actually move locations. Okay, so this notion of eventual consistency, okay, has been implemented in this class of protocols called epidemic protocols. Okay, so this is, I'll give you a quick intuition behind what this epidemic protocols. Okay, so there was a system called Bayou that was designed in Xerox PARC that actually came up with this notion of epidemic protocols. Okay. So this is basically based on the theory of epidemics. This is how diseases actually spread, real diseases, okay, not machine viruses. Yeah, although machine viruses use the same principle. So what happens in this case is when any machine sees an update, okay, the basic idea is if you see an update, you go and try to infect other machines. Okay, infect machine, you basically spread this update as quickly as possible. The faster you can spread this update through all the systems and infect all the machines, the better you are at enforcing consistency. Okay, so think of every update as a germ that you basically just picked up. Okay, the faster you spread it to all the replicas, the better off you are because you are making them consistent. Okay, that's the basic idea. And the basic the way this works is pairwise exchange. The way you spread diseases is you go and you shake hands with someone and you pass your germ to someone. So it's like pairwise update. So each machine here contacts some other machine and tries to infect that machine. Okay, so you do this pairwise exchange and eventually all machines will have seen that update. Okay, that's the basic idea behind what is called epidemic protocols for spreading updates through a replicated system. So it is useful in scenarios where there is weak consistency, okay, or rather not weak consistency, weak connectivity. Okay. All of the techniques we have been talking about so far assume that all replicas are actually connected to one another. But there may be scenarios where replicas are disconnected. Think of a laptop. Okay. Laptop may not always be connected to the network. You may actually fold up, go take a flight. Okay. Machine is not connected. If it's part of a distributed system and someone elsewhere has made an update, there's no way for you to even propagate that update even if you wanted to guarantee strong consistency. Okay? All consistency semantics that we studied only work if all machines are connected. If machines disconnect from the network, you can't enforce this guarantee. You can't spread, send updates to machines that are disconnected. So in a world where machines are frequently disconnected, okay, epidemic protocol work well. So what happens is every time a machine connects, the machine can talk to the server and say send me all the updates, or talk to a replica and say send me all the updates and pull all the updates, and then you disconnect and then you may make local changes. When you reconnect, you propagate your changes. Okay? If you actually read mail on your laptop, this is how mail will actually work on most laptops. Okay, you have a disconnected mode, you can actually send mail in disconnected mode. Mail is actually not going out, it's queued up on your local client. Okay. Subsequently, when you reconnect to the server, your mail client and the mail server talk. Okay. Mail client pushes all the mail you have actually written and is waiting to go out, sent out to the server, and then the server pushes all the new mail that has arrived back to your client. Okay. This is basically pairwise exchange between two machines. This is how PDAs or smartphones also synchronize. Okay. You might have PDA, you have a calendar on a PDA. Okay. You might make local changes. Okay. If this is a cell phone, that change can be propagated immediately over a cellular network. But assume it's a PDA. Okay. So you make local changes. When you resynchronize with your desktop, at that point you again do pairwise exchange. The PDA sends all of its updates to the PC. The PC sends all updates to your calendar to the PDA, and they both synchronize and they are both consistent at this point. So this is basically how many systems work essentially in any case. So that's what this technique is formalizing. So we have a couple of minutes, so let me talk a little bit more about this. So in any epidemic protocol, we will have two types of systems. An infected store. This is a store that has an update that it needs to send to someone else. And we'll have another set of machines that are called a susceptible store or susceptible machine. These are machines that need to be infected. They haven't actually seen the update. The basic idea is you have infected machines should try to propagate their infection to susceptible machines as quickly as possible and get everyone infected. And that's how you will basically make. So this is also giving you eventual consistency using pairwise exchange. So once everyone is infected, there eventually everyone becomes consistent. And then things are fine. So here are two implementations of epidemic protocol. The first one is called anti-entropy. Here server P picks a server Q that is connected to the system at random, and you exchange updates. So there are n replicas. Each replica at some point in time just contacts some other random replica and says, here are my updates, let me push them to you. If you have any updates, push them to me. So you could just be push, pull, or both. Okay? And you continue. So once you are done, you basically disconnect. At some later point in time, you pick some other machine at random, try to exchange updates and so on. So you are picking machines at random, and these two pairs of machines will communicate and exchange updates. Okay, this is one way of spreading updates through the system. Okay? This is called anti-entropy. Okay? Rumor mongering, which is also called gossiping. Okay, epidemic protocols are also called gossip protocols. Okay. This is how rumors spread. Okay. This is basically a push-based system. Okay. If P receives an update, okay, it tries to push it to other machines as quickly as possible. So what it does is, it basically contacts machine 1, tries to push the update, contact machine 2, tries to push the update, and so on. And until it sees that, it contacts a machine and it sees that it has already received an update, at that point it stops. This is very similar to how rumors are spread. So suppose you have some item of gossip that you want to spread. You will quickly call up 5 of your friends and try to tell them. Okay? You will stop when you figure out that this has become common knowledge, so there's no point in me calling 10 others because they probably know this by now. Okay? That's exactly how rumor mongering would work. Okay? So as soon as you receive an update, you quickly try to spread it or push it. But the moment you see that the machines you are trying to push it have already seen the update, you assume that now this is common knowledge, everybody has seen this piece of gossip, so you stop. Okay, so you have a random back off. So if Q has already received the update, if P tries to push to Q, if Q already received it, you stop spreading the update with the probability 1 over Q. You toss a coin, okay, saying should I continue spreading it or should I back off and say it's common knowledge. At some point you will stop. That is basically rumor mongering. Okay, so you have anti-entropy, which is two machines at random exchange update, and rumor mongering, which is also called gossiping. You push these updates. Okay. Both give you eventual consistency. They are just two different ways of implementing this epidemic protocols and achieving eventual consistency. Okay. So since you have run out of time, I haven't actually talked about this analysis here. So I'll come back and finish this material next time. Yeah, so let's stop there for today.